Court of Opinion Supplemental. This date is June 21st, 2020. It is a Sunday, and might I add, a cloudy Sunday afternoon. I'm calling this Court of Opinion Supplemental because I didn't know where else to put it in the normal podcast, and I have a feeling that the topic that I want to discuss today would be normally irrelevant to some of the news articles and topics on the regular podcast. As I alluded to in our most recent episode, I said something about Buddhism, so I think a much better, more formal title for this episode, supplemental, is Buddhism, a Case Study in Social Justice. So let me just quickly lay out Buddhism for some of you who might not know. So I'll just go through the basics of this religion slash philosophy. I'll look at a specific, not really case study in of itself, but a culture and its application and how it reflects on today and specifically the West. And you can tell throughout that I'll throw in my opinion. As some of you may know, Buddhism was founded by a man named Gautama Siddhartha sometime between the 6th and the 4th century BC. So, it can be set 500 years before Jesus. Within Buddhism, there are some sets of tenets that are very key to this faith. In understanding the world, Buddhism has something called the Four Noble Truths. And let me go through that with all of you. So in these Four Noble Truths, truth number one, all existence is dukkha. Dukkha can be translated in a few ways, and I'm looking at thebuddhistcenter.com for it, if you want to follow along. Dukkha can be translated as suffering, anguish, pain, or being unsatisfactory. The most common word that's used throughout history, especially in the West, is the term suffering. So all existence is suffering. There is suffering everywhere in this reality. Noble truth number two. The cause of suffering is craving or desire. Here it says the natural human tendency is to blame our difficulties on things outside ourselves. But the Buddha says that their actual root is to be found in the mind itself, in particular our tendency to grasp at things, or alternatively, to push them away, and it places us fundamentally at odds with the way life really is. So our desires for certain things, for comfort, for nice cars, for a roof over our heads, and then this idea of pushing things away, a desire to not feel it or see it or obtain it. So pushing away temporary pains, that's also considered under truth number two. Truth number three, the cessation of this suffering comes with the cessation of this craving, of these desires. Pretty straightforward. In order for us to take away this suffering, we must also let go of or take away this sense of desire. And truth number four, there is a path or there is a way that leads away from the suffering. So more or less, I kind of see it as three noble truths. First thing is there's suffering in the world. Two, suffering comes from this desire. And in order to get rid of the suffering is to get rid of desire. And then number four is there's a way. Now, what is this way? Essentially, noble truth number four leads us to another tenet that's very key in Buddhism called the Eightfold Path. And I'll just list them right away. And to be honest with you, I'm just looking at Wikipedia right now. So the Eightfold Path, there are eight divisions or eight parts to this path. And let me list them for you right now. Number one, right view. Number two, right resolve or intention. Number three, right speech. Number four, right conduct or action. Number five, right livelihood. Number six, right effort. Number seven, right mindfulness. Number eight, right samadhi or meditation. Sorry. And within the Eightfold Path, it can be split into three specific unique sections. Wikipedia does it pretty well. So splitting that up, you have moral virtue, which includes 3, 4, and 5. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. You have meditation, which is number 6, 7, and 8. Right effort, right mindfulness. Right samadhi, or meditation, or concentration. And the third part, insight or wisdom, that having the first two, right view and right resolve. So, hopefully you guys got that down. Of course, part of the way that Buddhism formed, it formed more or less out of Hinduism, because of the culture of India and the way that that religion had its stronghold and still does in the region. The idea of reincarnation, where each person is born, ages, gets sick and dies, and that becomes a cycle. So if you can imagine a wheel of life, each person will be born, they will grow up, they will get sick, sick in relative terms, and they die. So, in fact, you could probably dial it down to three. You are born, you age, you die, more or less. And this cycle continues on with each person. So you could imagine someone's soul constantly going through this process for generations, for lifetimes, constantly and constantly and constantly. Another part of Buddhism and Hinduism is this idea of karma. Now, a lot of people use this term, like, oh, karma's gonna get you. It's used slightly differently in Buddhism and Hinduism, Karma is the idea where the actions you perform will have consequences in the future. And specifically for these Eastern religions, is that the actions you do in this lifetime will affect you in the next lifetime, in the next reincarnation cycle. So if you have good actions, you will be rewarded in your next life with good actions being done unto you. And the same can be said with bad actions. So that's kind of like thinking about that there. Of course, there's in Buddhism, there's something called enlightenment or nirvana, where someone who successfully removes oneself from desires and suffering becomes enlightened and can break this cycle of reincarnation. Now, I'm not going to dwell too much on that just yet. The question I have for you all is, you know, just think about how the West, I'm thinking about European countries, European nations, as well as the United States, North America, how is Buddhism portrayed in the West? And I already wrote down a few things, like definitely kung fu movies, right? Definitely a lot of people have watched Kung Fu movies, know of Kung Fu movies, tried to imitate them. You have a lot of martial arts schools here as well. And from that, you can also imagine that Buddhism is practiced by monks in robes. They're bald, they chant a lot, they seem to be peaceful. Of course, you can imagine Shaolin Temple where they're also teaching Kung Fu and stuff like that. But this idea of peaceful, in fact, all of these portrayals that I just listed, which of course are stereotypes, definitely does not capture Buddhism as a whole. Nor does it even capture half of it. This idea of peaceful, you have these peaceful monks. You have so many people practicing Buddhism, say in Myanmar, for example. There are so many news reports out that the government of Myanmar, whose state religion is Buddhism, you have the government itself persecuting the Rohingya people in that country. You also have Buddhists in Southeast Asia persecuting the Muslim minority populations in Southeast Asia as well. So, you know, that's just me kind of going off tangent here for a second. Ooh, that sounds like a nice car. I hope you guys heard that muffler of that car that passed by. Now let's go on to this kind of like case study. So, I want to transport all of you to the country of Cambodia, of course, the country of my ancestors, specifically the Khmer Rouge regime, and specifically the genocide. So this Khmer Rouge regime, a communist regime, took over the country on April 17th, 1975, but they lost power in January 7th, 1979. So that's a little over 3 years. Between 1.5 million and 2 million Cambodians died during this regime, either by execution, starvation, and or disease. The Khmer Rouge regime, their goal was to push the country towards an agrarian society, eliminating all forms of Western influence, all forms of education. Some of you might know about the Khmer Rouge regime and the genocide that occurred there. Some of you might not if you haven't. And even if you have and like more information, definitely the internet is full of awesome, relatively. A lot of details and history about this time. Because the U.S. is kind of guilty, too, in their political plays in Southeast Asia at the time. So, let's look at Cambodia today. How are they right now in terms of recovering from this genocide? If you search up the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, the international world, the UN, created a tribunal to find and try top officials of the Khmer Rouge regime for acts against humanity. So definitely there were a few top officials that were captured, arrested, put on trial. Definitely at least one of them passed away during the trial. I think there was one or two that were actually convicted for these atrocities, for these crimes against humanity. If you dive a little deeper, you can see that there are quite a few Cambodians, the Prime Minister being one, very complicated issue, that does not want to continue these trials. Of course, it costs a lot of money for these trials to occur, for paying officials, law officials, to actually find and capture these people and bring them to trial. So, you know, just purely from a monetization sense, from a cost perspective. Okay, yeah. But I have a feeling that the Prime Minister's not alone. Of course, he has a lot of... There's a lot of political history in his reasoning as well. The reason why I say that there are a lot of... Quite a few... Cambodians who don't want this trial to go on is that they want to move on with life. They want to forget it. They don't want to confront or remember or specifically relive those experiences and horrors in those 3 years. Now, how does Buddhism fit into this? Cambodia is a majority Buddhist nation, over 98%, I believe. Definitely 90, at least 95%. Based on the top of my head, probably 98% is Buddhist. I mentioned reincarnation and karma. Again, karma is essentially what are your actions in this life. All of them. And more or less, let's keep a running tally, and then in your next life, karma will be there as a consequence of your previous life. Therefore, you have a lot of Buddhists perform acts of charity. So that's why the general stereotype of Buddhists is that they're really peaceful, is because committing violence or indifference to people is seen as bad karma. However, all of these acts of charity, at least from a first-hand experience, is that it seems like it's very personal, it's very individual, sometimes communal. But mostly it's this sense of this karma, or I'm committing acts of charity for myself and for my family, so that the karma, the good karma that I build up, will be there in my next life, in my children's next life. Moreover, if I follow the Eightfold Path as I kind of like, you know, described it and listed it for you earlier, if I follow the Eightfold Path, and I hope that people around me who are also Buddhists follow that, then the next life will definitely be better. Now let's rewind that. What does it mean for me if in this lifetime, what does it mean if I had to live through an atrocity like the Khmer Rouge genocide? What does it mean for my village? What does it mean for my country if the entire nation had to live through this atrocity? What does it say about the karma that we are facing now? What happened in our previous life? Again, let's go back to reincarnation. If my life now is relatively well off, middle class, driving nice cars and stuff, what does it say about the previous life, the karma, the sins or lack thereof? What about people born into poverty in this life that I see on the streets? What about an entire nation, as I asked earlier, facing, living through, suffering through the genocide? I believe that my people see this current state of affairs in Cambodia as a consequence from the sins, from the karma of the past. So that's this case study here. This is me trying to understand why there are so many Cambodians of the older generations who lived through this genocide, why there are so many who don't really talk about it. Of course, my mom talks about it once in a while because she understands the value of teaching me and my brother the history so that it will not be repeated. Took her a lot of courage to do that. Now let's bring this back. Let's try to translate this to the West, or at least let me try to translate this to the West. In understanding, kind of like the title I said earlier, what does Buddhism have to do with social justice? Generally, it seems to me, because of the lack of media coverage, either because the media doesn't care or because in reality there aren't many Buddhist Asian Americans, that generally Buddhist Asians in America, you know, Buddhist temples and Buddhist communities, are not as active in social justice here in America. And again, you know, you always factor in this sense of cultural difference, language barriers, of course. But let's look at this Buddhist understanding of life. What I laid out in trying to understand the sins of the past in Cambodia, the sin of genocide. If people who live through that atrocity don't talk about it, as do over 50% of Cambodians, I promise you, that is a consequence of how Buddhism is rooted in our lives. Buddhism as practiced does not live up to alleviating the suffering as a whole, as a community, as a human race, as a human family. The sense of liberation theology in Christianity, the sense of womanist theology, the sense of mestizo theology that Christianity has, there is definitely a lack of that in Buddhism as a whole. And of course, absolutely, you can talk about the small differences in history, specifically if you look at Tibet and how Tibetan Buddhists have self-immolated in order to bring to light on the world stage the inequalities that China has forced onto the country of Tibet. There is not enough of that. That, what the Tibetan monks have been doing, that is much closer to what the Eightfold Path is supposed to be. Now, you might have heard of the term the middle way that's sometimes used when people describe Buddhism or when you're learning about Buddhism. This idea, in fact, let me share you an adapted story that Cambodians have when talking about the Buddha and how he gained enlightenment. Again, adapted. There are slight variations to this story, but this is a story that was told to me by my mom as I was growing up. That the Buddha, in trying to reach enlightenment, starves himself. Some of you might know that the Buddha was born into a very wealthy family, could have been a very strong soldier, general, even a king, lived very well off, saw some suffering when he snuck out to see his people, and decided to become a monk. And in order to understand life, he decided to starve himself close to death. And when he passed out from one of these starvation tactics, his mother, who passed away, came to him in a dream and started playing a sitar. But it didn't sound right. The mother said, "Oh, the strings are too loose. Let me tighten it." And she tightened it and she tried playing it. And she tightened it too much. And when she was playing the sitar, it sounded very tight. So she said to her son, "Oh, I tightened the strings too much. Let me loosen it just a little bit, right in the middle, right in the Goldilocks zone. And she played the sitar beautifully to wake him up. And there, he had this revelation, this enlightenment, where this idea of the middle way, not too tight, not too loose, not too extreme on either sides, that the middle way is the only way to gaining enlightenment. Now, why am I talking about this sense of middle way? I'm not saying you should apply this to Western politics and looking at the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and looking at the left wing and the right wing and say, oh, let's be centrist because that's what Buddha wanted. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the middle way is the way of life, is the way of the Eightfold Path, is the way of justice, is the way of liberation, where everyone is free. No one is a slave, no one is a master, no one is starving to death, no one is being a glutton. That no one has their rights taken away, and no one has extra rights given to them because of their skin of color. The middle way is the way that everyone has the same rights. The rights to their life. The rights to dignity. That is the middle way. And I posit to you that someone needs to look at Buddhism in a critical lens and start creating some sort of liberation philosophy instead of trying to have good karma, to create acts of charity, to commit acts of charity for the next life, instead of doing little bits here and there so that, you know, in my future life, I'll get nirvana. The question is, how do we find nirvana in this life? Not just for me, but for my neighborhood, for my city, for my state, for my country. How do I find this sense of liberation from this suffering, not just for myself, but for my brothers and sisters out there in the street today? I say to you that Buddhism, as it is practiced, is not enough. There are not enough Buddhists out there marching in the streets for our black brothers and sisters. That Buddhism should be finding other ways to describe how we can reach this liberation. How can we reach this middle way? Personally, I don't want to go back to school studying philosophy and stuff just to write a book or two about it. I want to take the easy way out and just say somebody else figure it out, and I'm just laying the foundations. But in this Court of Opinion supplemental, as you could tell, there really isn't any other place I can put this topic. Let me know whether or not you guys agree or disagree. My email again is bnbapodcast@gmail.com. bnbapodcast@gmail.com. Next week's episode will be back to normal. The week after that, I'm juggling. I feel like I want to go on this journey of looking at religions from a different perspective and seeing whether or not they're doing enough. Like as I mentioned earlier about Christianity, there's a lot of liberation theology that's in there that's rich. Question becomes, why aren't all Christians following it? Why are there so many Christians who pay attention to one life, but not the other. Again, that's just a separate topic, which will hopefully be another Court of Opinion supplemental in the near future. Thank you guys for listening to me, because this is a weird episode. I definitely wish that you all see hope through all things, through all peoples, because that's the most important thing. That if I demand you see the inherent dignity in me, if I demand you see the inherent dignity of people in prison, I too must come to the conclusion that I see the dignity that you have as well as the oppressor. And it is our goal, in order for all of us to reach this true nature of love, of justice, of mercy, that all of us have to see the dignity in one another.